Over the course of this week, we're examining how the U.S. built its immigration system, the apparatus, the policies, and how this history is also about present-day race and racism in our communities. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Roughly 45 million immigrants lived in the U.S. in 2019. That's a historical high mark since census records have been kept and data courtesy there of the nonpartisan USA Facts. What are the key moments of immigration policy over the decades that speak to where we are today and who is let into America, how they are treated? 800-642-1234. Caitlin Dickerson is a staff writer for The Atlantic covering immigration. Caitlin, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much.
Well, we'll start with current events and the Biden administration's policies toward immigration and move out from there. You know, Afghan refugees who are temporarily being housed at Fort McCoy in Wisconsin, we have the latest estimates about 8,800 refugees. What are conditions like for these refugees coming now to the U.S.?
So the conditions in the processing centers themselves are, you know, on American military bases, like the one you mentioned, and abroad. Some people are waiting in transit countries. You know, it's very chaotic and it's very packed as the United States tries to rush to process people as quickly as possible. But I think you might mean in Afghanistan itself, you know, what people are trying to flee from as quickly as they possibly can. And that is kind of a more traditional, in some senses, background that refugees coming to the United States have come here for safety to escape. And I think, you know, we're all waiting to see what Taliban rule will look like this time around in Afghanistan. But certainly the concerns that people have based on past experiences have to do with very harsh kind of religious-based restrictions that especially bear down on women and prevent their movement throughout society, prevent them from being able to get an education, as well as just, you know, they're worried about a lack of stability and a lack of safety for themselves and their families.
The White House has acknowledged the politics of bringing refugees to the U.S. is tricky. And Press Secretary Jen Psaki said recently, we know that there are some people in this country, even some in Congress, who may not want to have people from another country come as refugees to the United States. That's a reality, she said. I'm wondering, will the Afghan resettlement play out in the way that the Obama administration had a difficult time bringing Syrian refugees, or is it different this time, Caitlin?
You know, what's interesting is that polling this time around is actually showing an overwhelming majority of Americans, including a majority of Republican Americans who tend to poll in lower numbers when it comes to support for resettling refugees. A majority across the political spectrum are showing support for resettling refugees from Afghanistan in the United States. I think that has to do, of course, with this long-standing military operation, a 20-year war. Many Americans served in the United States, and I think there's been enough coverage at this point, news coverage at this point, as well as personal experiences. You know, veterans who've gone to Afghanistan and come back and talked about, you know, how they worked hand in hand with people in Afghanistan who now, you know, many people believe deserve protection. And so I think, you know, it stands out, and apart from the polling in terms of resettling refugees from Syria under the Obama administration. And actually resettling Afghan refugees has more support, according to these numbers, than resettling them Vietnamese after the United States left the war in Vietnam. So we are dealing with a unique situation here, but there are concerns about vetting. I think you're hearing those a lot coming from people who tend to be more restrictionist, certainly in Congress, when it comes to resettling refugees. You know, people want to make sure that the vetting process is safe. It's happening on an expedited timeline compared to the way that it usually works. And so the Biden administration is going to great lengths to put those folks at ease, to let them know, you know, we're going to make sure that there's no one who's sneaking in through this process who's going to put the country at risk.
I want to look a little bit here at the refugee admissions cap, because in May, President Biden revised the annual cap to 62,500 for this fiscal year. And in a statement, he said the sad truth is that we will not achieve 62,500 admissions this year. Can you give us some context about the cap and the refugee admissions program?
Sure. This is actually, I think, a good kind of reflection of the very politicized nature of immigration and refugee resettlement, because, you know, when President Biden was running for office and soon after he was elected, he had promised to establish a refugee cap that was even higher than it, than President Obama, who has the kind of record for the historic high. He'd set a record of 110,000 refugees to resettle. The U.S. never quite reached that number, but that was the goal under Obama's final year in office. And then Biden said he wanted to beat it and go even higher. But then remember, you know, the Biden administration changed its mind and backpedaled and then kind of settled somewhere in between its initial high goal and the number that it's laid out now. And that's because this is a contentious issue. And it does, I think, in many cases, go back to vetting. Americans are concerned and want to make sure that people coming in through refugee resettlement are safe, are not going to put the country at risk. And also just generally speaking, you know, how the country is feeling about a new population of foreigners, you know, when we're in a crisis situation where, you know, in this case, it's the global pandemic, when we've been in the past in financial crises in the country, those tend to be moments in time when the public sentiment kind of contracts and people start to question why so many people are being allowed into the United States. It's not abnormal. You know, the Biden administration has said we're not going to meet the cap that they put into place this year. That's not abnormal. And it is a cap. And the vetting process is slow. In particular, in the first year of a new administration, they're going to be going through all new applications and they've got new people in their offices, and it's a process that they don't want to rush. So that's why I think you saw them land somewhere in between their initial high goal and then something that was more realistic.
We're talking with Caitlin Dickerson, staff writer at The Atlantic, as we explore the narrative of U.S. history, past and present, whether we are a nation of immigrants. Your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Owen is joining us from Waiawiga. Hi, Owen. Your thoughts.
Good morning, Kate.
Good morning.
Yeah, I have firsthand experience because I work with undocumented immigrants. As everyone knows, most of the migrant and undocumented labor here throughout the country that works in agriculture has been residing here permanently for many, many years, some of them 15 or 20 years, with no ability to seek or obtain citizenship. And I think we're failing to remind ourselves that democracy is supposed to function with the population being able to vote and cast a vote that's going to influence politics in the direction they want it to go. And if our labor in this country has no ability to represent themselves, we're going to continue to see the atrocities that we're seeing now with abuse and neglect of the working class and the population that feeds this nation.
Owen, thank you. You know, Owen referring there to migrant employees working on Wisconsin dairy farms, not having those constitutional rights, Caitlin.
He's right. And, you know, 7 in 10 Americans polling has shown support the idea of providing a pathway to legal status for farm workers. Undocumented farm workers do the vast majority, as Owen pointed out, not just in Wisconsin, but across the country, of agricultural labor in the United States. And they're also very highly represented in other industries, you know, in meatpacking plants, in the hospitality industry, in the construction industry, in the service industry, whether it's working in a restaurant in the kitchen or whether it's delivering food to our doors, as so many undocumented workers did during the pandemic and early stages of the pandemic when communities were really locked down. So there is a lot of support among the electorate to provide a pathway there to help those folks. And I think, as Owen pointed out, you know, it would completely change the landscape and the economic and kind of emotional and social future of generations of people living in the United States, because you've got millions of undocumented immigrants who have U.S. citizen children. You know, you've got, as he pointed out, a majority of those who are living in the U.S. undocumented have been in the U.S. for more than 15 years. I think it's 1 in 3 has a U.S. citizen child. And so, you know, and there are ripple effects of being of that kind of disenfranchisement that Owen was describing. You know, for example, for students who don't have legal status in some states, they're not eligible for in-state tuition for college, you know, which completely changes a person's prospects of being able to attend college at all. You know, they may not be eligible for a driver's license, even though they need to drive to get to work, but that then makes them vulnerable every time they get in the car to potentially getting pulled over and then deported. So it's a very precarious way to live, and it's a lot of people living living in that situation, as Owen pointed out, they really help to prop up the American economy. And at the same time, you know, that's balanced with concerns that Americans have now and have always had, if we're going to go back and talk about the history, about letting people in. And again, I guess I would emphasize that that's always especially true during times of crisis.
We are taking a long look at immigration policy with the Atlantic staff writer Caitlin Dickerson, covers immigration. How would you solve the immigration crisis? How do you feel President Biden is doing with immigration measures? What policies should be implemented? What can be done for Dreamers and Wisconsin farm workers? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up in a minute with Caitlin Dickerson here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. All this week, we're taking a look at immigration issues through time, how to resolve complex questions around border control, around asylum, citizenship, and what it means for the face of America. Earlier this summer, 84 mayors from across the nation, including Madison, signed on to a letter to President Biden pushing for immigration reform. So how do you talk about immigration with your family and neighbors? Do you live in a mixed status family or know someone facing deportation? How has the immigrant crisis hit home? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. The Atlantic staff writer Caitlin Dickerson covers immigration, stays with us for about 9 more minutes. Caitlin, some people refer to the U.S. as a nation of immigrants, and President John F. Kennedy often alluded to this idea during his time. This is Kennedy addressing the Anti-Defamation League in 63.
It is a proud privilege to be a citizen of the great republic, to hear its song sung, to realize that we are the descendants of 40 million people who left other countries, other familiar scenes, to come here to the United States to build a new life.
Those building block words, where did this phrase come from and who did it include?
Sure. So this is a really interesting question to me, one that I actually decided to dig into and interrogate in my last piece for The Atlantic, looking at the history of this narrative of the U.S. as a nation of immigrants. It's something that I grew up learning in public school in a community in the Central Valley of California that had people from all over the world. And I was surrounded by not just first generation, but second, third generation students whose families were from Mexico, from Central South America, from East Asia, Southeast Asia. And so when I learned in school that we are a nation of immigrants, it makes a lot of sense. You think, okay, that must have always been the case. But what I found out is, you know, the 1960s, that era that we were just referring to, and we heard JFK speaking, that's actually the first time that this narrative was popularized, which kind of came as a shock to me. It's pretty recent. And it was part of the civil rights movement and this push to eliminate race-based quotas that existed in our immigration laws. And when you look back at the history of those laws, there's a way in which you see almost the opposite of what we're kind of taught in school, that this was, you know, a country that was intentionally built to welcome people from anywhere in the world, you know, regardless of race or creed, and kind of offer them protection from persecution, which was, you know, the idea in establishing the United States to begin with. You know, you go all the way back to our first immigration law codifying citizenship in 1790. And that at the time, citizenship was legally limited to free white men. Mm. And you take it forward from there to, you know, 1882 Chinese exclusion to in 1917, our next immigration law barred anyone from Asia at all. And then, of course, you get to the Johnson-Reed Act of 1924, which established these race-based quotas and immigration laws. So at each of these junctures, you see how immigration laws were actually created in the United States for the purpose of keeping the country white. And that definition of who qualifies as white and who doesn't, it evolved and changed over time. And so you see different groups being brought into the fold, immigrants from, you know, Ireland, who originally weren't considered white, and then from Southern Europe, and then ultimately Jewish immigrants, you know, in the 60s era push that JFK is trying to push forward. That's when you see the definition expand even more. But, you know, in these early decades and really, you know, over 100 years of laws that were sort of race-based in nature and explicitly, you know, you would hear eugenic scientists, you know, coming into the United States Congress, presenting their ideas and making these arguments that were compelling at the time that basically argue this is a debunked form of science that argued for the racial superiority of people who were of Northern and Western European ancestry. And so these are the experts that Congress was relying on in establishing these laws that were designed to, again, kind of create the opposite of the picture that is painted in school. When you hear this narrative of a nation of immigrants, you see people from all different countries and all different backgrounds and races. And in fact, the laws were created to do the opposite.
You also write a portrait of David Dorada Romo's aunt, who would commute from Mexico into South Texas for her job in housekeeping. What did you find most significant about Aunt Adela's story and the life of a Mexican immigrant?
So David Romo and his family's story was striking in that it really illustrated in a way I wasn't familiar with the very disparate way that different groups of migrants had been treated in the United States going back a very long time. So, you know, I first read about David and the story he tells about his aunt who the Border Patrol had melted her shoes going back and forth to work into the United States. Legally, she had a visa as part of a program that existed all the way into the 1940s, where immigrants coming specifically from Mexico, and this is important to point out that it's those who were coming legally with visas, they were forced to bathe each time they crossed the southern United States border, and their clothing was run through chambers where they were exposed to different chemicals and gases to clean them. This is obviously based on the idea that immigrants coming in from Mexico were inherently more, you know, less clean, or were inherently more, you know, needing of bathing and, you know, delousing and things like that than immigrants coming from other countries who were not inspected in this same way. So this is a Border Patrol policy that went on for decades. And then, you know, I was even more shocked and interested to learn from David Romo. He became a historian of the Southwest border and discovered that it was actually those chambers created by the United States Border Patrol that caught the attention of scientists in Nazi Germany, who then suggested the idea of beginning to use gas chambers in camps. And you know, they discovered that Zyklon B, which was the chemical that the United States Border Patrol was using to clean people's clothing and you know, the kind of clothing like David's Aunt Adela's shoes, which melted in a gas chamber. And the scientists basically discovered if you turned up and used a greater amount, a greater concentration of that gas, that it could be used to endanger, harm, wow, kill human beings. And that's the history of those gas chambers and concentration camps.
We're talking with Caitlin Dickerson, staff writer at The Atlantic, as we talk about the immigration through time, the policies in our country, and how these past policies have to do with the makeup of our communities today. We're at 800-642-1234. I want to fast forward here. The Biden administration responded to the pandemic by using Title 42 of the U.S. Public Health Code to rapidly expel border crossers without allowing them to seek asylum. Caitlin, what is the status of Title 42? What is its impact?
So Title 42 remains in place now. It was first introduced by the Trump administration as a way to effectively try to seal the southern border. It applies to the northern border as well, but in practice, you don't see it having as great an impact because it really applies to people who are trying for the most part to enter without prior permission, you know, without visas. So I do want to emphasize this because I've gone back and forth during the pandemic to Mexico many times and had absolutely no problem. But Title 42 is this public health authority established, I believe, in the 1940s, and it allows the president, working with the Surgeon General, to say, you know, if we're in a time of crisis, we can prevent people from coming into the United States. But you have all these exceptions that end up allowing people to move back and forth for trade, people to move back and forth as long as they have visas. So really the primary population of people who are impacted by this restriction are asylum seekers. the Trump administration introduced this, and then when President Biden took office, they left it in place, which was very controversial. And you see the Biden administration just juggling with a number of different issues right now. You know, their desire to open up immigration policies, they've laid out an immigration plan that's incredibly expansive. It's a wish list that a lot of people don't think they're ever going to be able to achieve, but it's one that really would, you know, offer legal status and opportunities to so many different categories of immigrants. And yet at the same time, numbers of people crossing the border was rising really dramatically, and kind of the opposite effect that we saw in the few months after President Trump took office. We saw border numbers drop really low. He'd campaigned on this idea of coming down, you know, really harshly on immigrants, and especially those without prior permission to come to the United States. And President Biden campaigned partially on the idea of eliminating President Trump's restrictions.
Reversing that, yeah.
Exactly. And so that was potentially a factor, as well as the fact that there were so many travel restrictions within Central and South America throughout the pandemic. It was really hard to move throughout those places. They had lockdowns that were more severe than ours in many cases. And so you had a lot of people who for the first time were actually able to move around and, you know, felt they needed to try to come to the United States. So the Biden administration is juggling all these different things and has chosen to keep Title 42 in place.
And Caitlin, we're out of time. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Caitlin Dickerson, staff writer for The Atlantic. News update is next on the Ideas Network.